This is Fresh Air. I'm Tanya Mosley, and my guest today is stand-up comedian and late-night talk show host Taylor Tomlinson. She hosts CBS's After Midnight, which bills itself as the smartest show on TV about the dumbest things on the internet.
My show After Midnight, and this is my outfit today. Do you like it? Thank you, but no offense, there's only one opinion that matters. The only one I care about is this random guy on Reddit who's been ranking my outfits. Yep. This is real. He uses a scale from elite to nah, which I think is the metric system. I'm not sure. I'd make fun of this, but this person clearly has watched every episode of the show, so I think I might be in love. In fact, this is the only ranking I care about. Some late night hosts worry about ratings and ad sales. Not me. I wake up in a cold sweat, like, is Reddit user 21puppets gonna think my blazer is mid? Seems a little to do to the only woman in late night.
That was my guest Taylor Tomlinson performing the opening monologue on CBS's After Midnight, which took the time slot vacated last year by the Late Late Show with James Corden. When Tomlinson took that slot, headlines described her as the youngest female late night host on network television. Taylor got the stand-up bug when she was 16, performing at open mics in church basements and schools and coffee shops in Orange County, California, where she grew up. Her humor is self-deprecating and rapid-fire, and almost nothing seems to be off the table. Her topics range from the perils of dating on apps to finding out she has bipolar disorder. Taylor has three stand-up specials on Netflix, Quarter Life Crisis, Look at You, and this year's special, Have It All. She'll soon be traveling the country performing stand-up with her Save Me tour. Taylor Tomlinson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've been doing your show on CBS for a few months now, and I heard that Stephen Colbert gave you advice when you first started hosting. What did he say?
Oh, gosh. I mean, Stephen is the executive producer on our show, so he's given me so much great advice. But some of the most helpful advice he gave me was sort of just to not expect myself to be perfect right away. I think that really helped me set my expectations for myself and say, you're not going to be amazing right away, and you don't need to be as flawless as you think you need to be. He's like, people are just going to be happy to see you and happy to hang out with you. You know, like, that's what I love about our show and late night shows in general. I think they're a real comfort watch for people. They're consistent. They're something that people watch either every night as they're going to sleep or like in the morning while they're getting ready or on their lunch break. And I love that our show gets to be something like that. I love being a part of something like that, a daily point of comfort for people.
Well, it definitely feels like you're gaining your stride. You're settling in the seat, even though there is no seat. You're standing up the whole time.
Yes, exactly.
And people describe this show as kind of like the Jeopardy of dumb internet culture. How do you describe it?
Oh, I think that's a good description. I mean, it has a lot of elements of so many of my favorite shows growing up. Like, I think there's a combination of, like, Whose Line Is It Anyway? America's Funniest Home Videos.
Yeah.
And all the late night shows. I think it's sort of settled into that. We're like, there is a monologue now. There is a talk show portion that we started as us kind of making fun of it and now has sort of evolved into almost like an actual talk show. So, and you know, you watch most late night shows now and they are playing games. They're just doing it with like one guest. So what I thought was like setting us apart is actually something everyone's doing now every night. So I think the late night space is changing and evolving across the board. And I think the internet has a lot to do with that. And so our show focusing on the internet specifically and the dumb trends and the funny little videos that go viral, as opposed to like hard hitting news, is maybe what sets us apart a bit.
You are being described as one of the voices of a generation. And that's because you're able to articulate the fear and anxiety of being a young adult right now.
you can have us laugh to keep from crying, really. But I just wonder, like, how does that translate to the confidence we see on stage? I think one of your best friends has said in an old article that they watched you turn into someone else on stage. So is this person on stage we see, is it like a persona, like Beyonce and Sasha Fierce? Is that what you do to kind of get yourself? Because you're kind of facing your worst fear every single night.
That's true. I don't think it's a persona. I don't think it's a character. I think it's just the best version of me. You know, I think it's the sharpest, quickest, wittiest, most confident version of myself. I just can't keep that up very long is maybe what it is. But I think when I started doing stand-up in high school, it felt like more of a persona, but it felt like the version of myself that I knew I could be and wanted to become, but wasn't yet. And I think over the years, who I am off stage and who I am on stage have come together where I do feel that I am the same person everywhere. Maybe the energy levels are different, but I do feel that if you meet me on the street or after a show, you're not going to feel like, well, that wasn't who we know from her stand-up.
Yeah.
Right. I would hope so. I mean, yeah. I have had friends say like, oh, I thought you'd be, you know, more outgoing or something. And I'm like, no, I'm still not comfortable socially, I think. But I wish I was. I wish I had that. But you got to accept who you are.
Yeah, it's one of the things that you talk about in your stand-up. You joke about the anxiety you feel. You joke about your mental health challenges in a way that normalizes it. I actually want to play a clip from your 2022 Netflix comedy special, Look at You. And in this clip I'm going to play, you talk about how you came to be diagnosed with bipolar disorder.
I'm so glad I know that I'm bipolar now. I mean, I have the right meds. I got a mood ring. I'm handling it. But when I first found out, it was a very tough pill to swallow. And I've swallowed a lot of pills. Because when you first find out something like that, you're like, oh, man, am I going to tell anybody? Should I tell anybody? And if I do tell people, am I hot and or talented enough to be an inspiration? Like if I have a thing and someone else has that thing and they find out I have it too, are they gonna feel good or bad with that information? Because when I got diagnosed, they started listing names. They were like, you know who else is bipolar? Selena Gomez. And I was like, that does make me feel better. She is very pretty. Okay, I'll be bipolar.
That was my guest, Taylor Tomlinson, in her 2022 Netflix comedy special, Look at You. Taylor, first of all, that's just funny. I'm like, okay, she's pretty. Okay. Also, there's this thing you say right before that where you actually talk about the process of finding out that you were bipolar. And one of the things was just through a cocktail of medications over time. And I thought that was really fascinating, that's one of the ways that you can be diagnosed. How long did it take for you to find out that right combination?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I think I tried so many antidepressants and they weren't working for me and I was having terrible side effects. So it was like years of that. It was years of like, okay, I'll try something. And then it wouldn't go well. And I'd go, well, forget that. I'm just going to eat a lot of spinach and exercise and I'll be fine. And I can stay afloat as long as my partner doesn't leave me and nothing goes wrong. You know, like it was certainly a years long process trying to find what worked for me. And then when I finally did find what worked for me, I sort of worked backwards from that and was like, oh, this makes sense. Is it maybe this? And look, there are so many mental health illnesses that have similar symptoms. I think there's probably more labels that could have been put on my particular set of struggles. But as long as you find the right tools, the right medication, the right routine for you to feel better and feel stronger and get to a place where you can count on yourself, I don't think it really matters. And I had so much shame around that diagnosis when I first got it. And I was embarrassed that I felt ashamed because I've never judged anybody else who had it. But when it's you, it's like somehow different, which is why I started writing jokes about it.
How did you push yourself to say, I'm going to joke about it? Because you take so many parts of yourself and bring them on stage. How did you decide that, like, hey, I'm just going to let this out?
I remember my therapist said to me, maybe we don't talk about this on stage. And I was like, I've already done it. Like,
Wait, by the time you told your therapist, you had already started talking about it?
I think she knew before, but later on, she had said, well, and maybe that's why we don't talk about it on stage yet. And I was like, well, I didn't try something last week and it worked, so I'm probably going to start talking about it. Because once you write one joke and it hits and you really like the joke, you're like, well, it's got to go in the act. And I'm so glad that I did, because I got such amazing feedback from people who had been struggling with their mental health as well. Not even just from like a bipolar 2 diagnosis, like I got, like from a variety of things, and how it made them feel seen and less alone. And that was so rewarding and amazing and comforting for me. But when I filmed the special, I felt great about those jokes. And then in the months waiting for it to come out, I started panicking and was like, oh no, I can't unshare any of this. And over the years, I've gotten better about editing myself and deciding what is going to go in the act and what I'm just going to keep private. But it's a lot of trial and error, you know, like sometimes you don't know that you want to keep something private until you try it out on stage. And so you tell thousands of people and then go, well, I'm going to keep that private.
Is it the reaction that like brings that awareness, or how it feels? A combination of both, maybe.
For me, I think it's how it feels, because if something bombs, you're like, well, I just need to rework that. Like, I can write a joke about anything at this point. If it doesn't go well, I just need to rework it or find a different way into it. But the guiding light for me has been, even if something kills on stage, do I feel good telling it every night? Or do I dread that bit coming up? Like, I have done jokes about very personal things that I took out of the act because I was dreading getting to that part of the hour every night. And I was like, ooh, that's probably a sign that I'm not ready to talk about this yet, or I shouldn't be talking about this yet. I also run jokes by family members and friends before I do them, because a joke is not worth destroying a relationship, in my opinion.
You know what? The thing about you in this moment is that we are watching you grow on stage. You mentioned you recently turned 30. You started doing stand-up at 16. You really became popular a few years ago. And with that, though, I mean, there's so much growth and development that happens from 16 to 30, and there'll be so much more that happens from 30 on. Mm. I've actually heard some artists say that sometimes the edge in their work comes from the sadness or the depression or the anxiety. You're working out these things on the stage. You're also doing a lot of work, you know, in your life, going to a therapist, your medication. Has your comedy changed with your diagnosis, for instance, or the different things that you're doing therapeutically to basically heal yourself?
I think finding the right combination of medication, talk therapy, that has made me a more confident, steady person. And I was always somebody who was driven by my emotions. I felt like I was getting dragged around by my own feelings all the time. And it was exhausting and painful. And when I finally got on the right medication, I'm on a mood stabilizer now, it was like, not right away, obviously, because you have to sort of find the right dosage slowly. But I've had this moment many times in the last few years where I have sort of a flashback to where I was emotionally in my early 20s and think about how I feel now and how I'm able to count on myself and plan for things and not be worried that I'm going to fall apart. And it's just, it's incredible. I mean, I'm still so grateful for it. I really do feel like a different person. And I mean, part of that is just growing up too. I mean, I think there's a little more awareness around taking care of myself and making sure I don't burn out and don't fall apart emotionally and physically.
Did you have to fall apart in order for that to become an awareness? Have you had that yet? Or were you able to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the lowest I have ever been was the few months leading up to Quarter Life Crisis, my first Netflix special. I think the summer before that, I filmed it in November, and the summer before that was probably rock bottom for me. It's when I started seeing a psychiatrist because I just didn't know what else to do. And it's actually hard for me to watch it. Just not knowing, just not, I wasn't on any sort of medication because I had tried in the past and it didn't work. So I just gave up and I had a relationship end and was under an immense amount of pressure and felt like I wasn't sure if I could live up to the opportunity that was getting an hour-long Netflix special. And it was just a lot. I was just not in a good place mentally. And it was a huge, huge struggle. And even watching clips of Quarter Life Crisis now, I see somebody who was sort of manic. And I know how much pain I was in at the time. And I know that I had a panic attack that morning. And it makes me a little sad. But I also think the special's really good. So it's interesting because I do think that some of like the hypomania that I experienced in my 20s helped me get to this place in my career where it just feels like rocket fuel when you're in that space. But also when you hit those depressive episodes, you take, you know, it's like two steps forward, one step back type of thing. So I think it all evens out, but yeah, I do think I needed to hit rock bottom to commit to getting help and really figuring it out.
Your mom died when you were 8. Mm-hmm. And there's just this joke in one of your specials where you say to the crowd, "Do you think I'd be this successful at my age if I had a mom who was alive?" Mm-hmm. Do you really believe that?
Oh, yeah. That was something I said in therapy. I was having a hard therapy session, and I sort of, in the middle of venting in tears, I was just like, but you know, I probably wouldn't be successful if my mom were alive, so maybe it all is fine, right? And it was not funny in therapy, but it was funny on stage. Because I do kind of feel like that, even now. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody in comedy or any creative person has to come from this dark place and the only way you're funny is if you have a darkness about you. Like, I don't think that's true. But for me, that changed who I was and who I was going to become, and it changed my sense of humor, and it made me try really hard to prove myself in a way that I don't think I would have if she were still alive. Because after you lose a parent, you're still trying to impress them and you're still trying to be somebody that they would have liked and respected and loved and been proud of. And you're hoping other people who knew them tell you that. So I do think that a lot of me trying to become somebody of note creatively was due to that. I mean, there's a lot of things. There's a lot of factors, of course, but I think that was certainly a huge, huge one.
How did you discover stand-up?
I took a class in high school when I was 16. I took a class from a Christian comedian at a church. I think we worked off of Judy Carter's book. I think it's called like the stand-up comedy book or the stand-up comedy Bible. And it was really just like lists of things that made you angry, lists of things that made you excited, lists of things that made you sad. And I think it was just to get you thinking about what you had strong feelings about, because that's going to be the easiest and most interesting thing for you to write about. So I definitely think I still do that. I think when I'm actively sitting down to write new material, I do make lists of just topics I could see myself discussing in front of audiences for the next 2 years, because I know I'm going to have to sit with it for a while.
Some of your first gigs were the church circuit. What kinds of things would you joke about on the church circuit? And what is exactly the church circuit?
Look, churches put on events. Churches put on comedy shows. The only difference is they do an altar call at the end. But it's a stand-up show. It's someone doing 45 minutes to an hour of stand-up with an opener. And some of these churches are like theaters. They're 1,000 people to 5,000 people. Like, but yeah, most people are like, you were performing in churches? Is that even a thing? And I just fell into it because I was, you know, a church kid. Like, that's how I got into it. It's not a cool story. But I think a lot of my jokes were about how young I was, because I felt guilty making adults sit through a child talking for that long and watching a child try to get good at something. Like, I wanted to make them feel comfortable and call it out right away.
I can imagine they're a pretty supportive audience, though.
They were, yeah. Church audiences are very supportive as long as you don't say anything dark, edgy, or blue.
So you were joking about being young. Do you remember some of your first jokes?
I know I used to open with a joke about how I know I'm a lot younger than many of you. Like, when I watched Titanic, I was crying, not because Jack died, but because Leonardo DiCaprio didn't look like that anymore. It's like, that was my opening joke for a long time.
Did you have comics that you were looking up to or that you'd watch and you'd think, like, they're so good, or that joke is so good? Any folks you idolized?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there were so many that I idolized and thought were so good. I mean, Brian Regan was, like, huge in my house because he was clean and one of the greatest of all time. And I got to open for him a couple times in my early 20s, and he's, like, just as classy and cool and hilarious and kind offstage. So that was, like, very formative for me, I think, as far as being able to see somebody with the career I wanted and how nice he was to other people. And, like, you know, Marc Maron having a podcast where he just talked to other comedians about how they became comedians was huge. I mean, obviously now it's grown and evolved where it's not just comedians. It's all kinds of people, directors, actors, politicians, whoever. But at the time, he was just talking to comedians about how they did it. And I don't know how I would have learned how to come up in the clubs or do open mics or how to feature or anything like that without that podcast. I really,
wow,
really don't.
Wow, you'd just listen to the podcast.
Yeah, I couldn't. Yeah. I remember when I found it, I couldn't believe it was free. Like, I couldn't believe podcasts were free when I found out what a podcast was. Because it was just this, it was like a course. It was like a course on how to become a comedian. And I'm like, how did people outside of major cities figure this out before something like this?
I want to talk a little bit about your family. So many folks who knew your mom have basically taught you about her because she died when you were 8. Mm-hmm. I'm really moved by you saying you're hoping that those who knew her actually see her and you and are proud of you too. As you get older, do you see yourself in her?
I don't know. I think you're right that I do rely on other people's accounts of her, because there's only so much you remember when you lose somebody at 8 years old. So when people do give me those compliments, it means a lot to me. Like, my aunt has said to me, like, oh, your expressions on stage will remind me of her. Like, she and my grandma will say, like, oh, we saw you make this face. And we're like, oh, my gosh, that looks like Angela. And that means so much to me. And growing up, like, I wanted to be a writer before I wanted to be a comedian. And they would say, your mom was such a great writer. And there's so many ways I'm not like her. Like, she was an extrovert. She was very bubbly. She was very charismatic. She was gorgeous. Like, she was so many things that I wasn't and am not. I can pretend for a little bit, but I'm not one of those people who's just exuding light. And I think she was. And again, like, so beautiful, like, just not, I don't see myself in her in a lot of ways. Like, I don't think I shine as brightly as she does. And I, in a weird way, feel like my becoming a comedian and a professionally creative person and a writer is like my way of honoring the potential that was wasted by the universe taking her.
You've said you were afraid you were going to die at 34. Do you mm-hmm. still have that fear?
I actually don't. I think therapy helped a lot with that. And the last couple years, I've sort of felt that fear melt away because it is irrational. It makes sense, but it is irrational. So that's another place that I see growth in myself, mental health wise, is I don't feel this like deep belief that I'm also going to be taken from this world in a few years.
I think you described it as like you suffer from eldest child syndrome. So you're like the eldest of four. Mm-hmm. And you grew up Southern California, as we mentioned, very religious. The church experience changed for you when your mother died. You describe it as being fun, and then it wasn't. Can you say more about that?
I think it just rocked my world. I think it just went against what I had been told. I had been told, if you believe and pray and stay, you know, faithful, God will answer your prayers. And we had so many people praying for her, and she believed she was going to get better. And so to watch your mom die of cancer, even while everybody gathers around her and lays hands on her and supports her and prays for her, and then for them to turn around and go, well, God did heal her. He just healed her in a different way. She is healed. She's healed in heaven. And I was like, whoa, okay. The rewrite on that is crazy. Like, it made me question everything. And slowly over the next 10 years, I felt like I was struggling to stay in it the whole time I was growing up. And I just felt like I was a bad Christian because I didn't, in my heart, agree with everything. The idea that we would have figured out exactly who or what created us and what's going to happen when we die, like, I just can't even imagine feeling that way. Like, I just have no idea what happens, and I don't know how any of us would figure it out. Not that I'm against the idea that there might be a God or something more, like, I'm not at all. I think that's just as likely that there's nothing. But I really struggled with, like, we have this book, we have this manual, and everything written in it is what we believe and absolutely true. And so, yeah, I just sort of, as I got out of school and started doing stand-up, and stand-up is, you know, you're hanging out with people of all ages from all walks of life, like, coming up in comedy clubs and everything, and it really broke me out of the sheltered childhood I was coming from.
It's kind of like you went from one community to another community, like the community of comedy. And I'm just kind of curious, though, if there was ever any bouts of loneliness, because I sort of know what you mean. I've come from a religious family, too. And one of the things about falling out of love with religion that many people I hear say they didn't anticipate was the loneliness, because so much of religion is about community. You've got your youth groups. You've got, you know, all of the folks that rallied around you and your family when your mother passed away. Did you ever go through that breakup process of loneliness, just being out in the world without a community?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's what's so beautiful about religion is it can provide such comfort and such beautiful community when done the right way, when it's not being used as a fear tactic or a way to control people. But yeah, I was so afraid to admit that I didn't identify as a Christian anymore because I thought I was going to lose my family. Like, I thought it was going to separate me from them forever. And it hasn't, you know, for the most part. And it's been such a relief to not lose those people. And like, my mom was really religious. Like, that was very important to her. And it feels like letting her down in a way. It feels like letting down that entire side of my family. And but I know that they don't love me any less or accept me any less. But I do still wish that I fit into that mold because it would be easier. And I do look at like my cousins who are all such brilliant, smart, cool, successful, amazing people and still in the church. And I do feel jealous sometimes.
You talk quite a bit about your siblings. There are four of you. Mm-hmm. And something really interesting that you talk about in your latest stand-up is how you came out as queer. How did you come to that realization? And your siblings also identify as queer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's part of the reason I think I had so much resentment towards my religious upbringing is like, forget identifying as queer, or like you yourself being gay. Even if you believed in gay marriage, you were like not right with God, you know? Like, I think when I was in high school and I had those feelings, it was just something you kept to yourself or squashed because it just wasn't an option, you know, in the same way, like not being a Christian wasn't an option because you just lose everybody you cared about if that was true of you. And then again, I think over the years, like, you know, being bisexual comes with its own fears and insecurities and worries about judgment and being wrong and being accused of like just wanting attention. So I was like, very scared to come out for those reasons. But I think watching my younger siblings come out over the years was very inspiring to me and really did sort of pave the way for me, funnily enough, as their older sibling to do that, I think. Like, I think them validating me helped me feel more comfortable with it.
You talk about this in Have It All. You talk about the beauty of your relationships with your siblings just by virtue of you talking about them in the context of these funny scenarios that you bring up. And one of them, you also talk about how hard it is to date straight men. And this is in the context of one of your siblings who's talking about how amazing their relationship is. Let's listen.
Do you know how hard it is to continue dating straight men when you are surrounded by three queer relationships up close? Queer relationships are the most beautiful, thoughtful, creative things I've ever seen in my life. My sister and her partner are in a romance novel. Every time I talk to them, I'm like, hey, I know you had a hard week at work. You doing okay? And she's like, yeah, I did. So to cheer me up, my partner got me my favorite snack in a limited edition flavor. They got me a little vial of sand from the beach we went to on our first date. And you know how I always wanted an easy bake oven growing up and never got it? They found one on eBay. I'm like, oh my God, are they cheating on you? She's like, what? No, they just listen to me when I talk and remember things I say. And I'm like, what? No, go through their phone. This stinks. Go through their phone, trust me. She's like, okay, how are you and your boyfriend doing, Taylor? I'm like, oh, we're good. My boyfriend bought me a hot dog. because he wanted one, and I was there too.
That was my guest, comedian Taylor Tomlinson, from her latest comedy special, Have It All, on Netflix. I've been reflecting lately on how underrated sibling relationships are, like as part of just the discourse about family, because you all really are the closest things to each other. You're the only four people who share this particular makeup of DNA, you know?
Yeah, who know all of your secrets, who were there for your entire childhood. I mean, people talk about the significance of their best friends from childhood in their lives. And I have friends like that who have been in my life since I was 10 years old. But nobody else has been there from the time I was two, you know? Like, my younger sibling, Brynn, is like my best friend in the world and knows me better than anybody. And I would probably feel that way about them even if we weren't related, I think. Like, I just like who they are so much, and I respect who they are so much. And I feel so privileged to have that in my life, because I don't think everyone has that with their siblings. I think there are plenty of siblings who, you know, they see each other on holidays and they check in every once in a while. I feel really, really grateful.
Well, Taylor, this was a pleasure to talk with you, and I really thank you so much for this conversation.
This was so nice. Thank you so much for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Taylor Tomlinson is a comedian and host of the CBS Late Show After Midnight. She'll soon be traveling the country with her Save Me tour. This is Fresh Air.